The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We're getting deeper into the book of Vayikra, really the book of sacrifices, Korbanot. We spoke about that a little bit last week. And there is a very interesting mitzvah, which appears at the beginning of this week's portion, this week's parasha, which is rather bizarre. I want you to imagine for a moment, okay, that it's Yom Kippur. Not Yom Kippur today, not, you know, sort of going to synagogue in Arizona or Atlantic Beach or the Five Towns, but you're in Yerushalayim. And maybe even peace has actually broken out in the world. And maybe the Jewish people have actually gotten their act together, and maybe the Arabs have gotten their act together, and everybody got together and decided that the Jewish people deserve a break, and so they all got together and they built the Beit HaMikdash, they built the temple. And Mashiach came along, Mashiach being not some magical, mythical figure who walks on water, but rather an individual, descended of the Davidic line, a man of such sterling character, that the entire Jewish people actually is prepared to follow him, to listen to him, to learn from him. One of those rarest of individuals that you meet who is such a fine human being that you actually learn and grow just from being around him. The real deal, like they say. And he reestablishes the Sanhedrin, a high court of 71 of, I guess, the greatest rabbis probably in the Jewish world. And they form the body of Jewish tradition that the entire Jewish people can follow, can listen to. And a prophecy maybe returns. There's a Navi around somewhere. And the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt. The temple's rebuilt. And it's the first Yom Kippur, right? After 2,000 years plus, and maybe even you could say almost 3,000 years or 2,500 years since we've had a Beit HaMikdash, a temple on this level. And of course, the Beit HaMikdash is not just a building. It's a place where Jews can come together, where we can put our differences aside, an environment a person can go to experience what life could be like. And it's now Yom Kippur. And at least according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides, life won't change all that much. They'll still be poor, and there'll still be those who are sick, and all the lame won't be walking, and all the deaf won't be, you know, listening, and unfortunately, plenty of challenges will abound in the world, but people will get it. Monotheism will have spread through the world. There'll be an objective ethic. People will begin to do the right thing just because it's the right thing. But we'll still make mistakes, and we'll still need to work on them, and we'll still need to regret the mistakes that we've made and decide that we want to change our lives, and we'll still have Yom Kippur. Only on Yom Kippur morning, there'll be a whole service for the day that begins on the Temple Mount, on Har HaBayit, and there'll be a Kohen. And more than just Kohanim, there'll be a Kohen Gadol, a high priest. And he too will be a man of intense character, supposedly representative of the best qualities that human beings can achieve, the type of person who succeeds in making peace among his fellow men. And he will begin the service of the day. And you have to ask yourself, how would a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, in the temple on Yom Kippur, the first year we actually have this service again after thousands of years, how will he start his day? Will he offer up a prayer for the well-being of the world? Will he bring a sacrifice, maybe even not an animal sacrifice, offering up a whole grain burnt offering, representative of you know, the growth potential of the Jewish people? Will he do penance over a sacrifice representative of the desire to gain forgiveness of the Jewish people? So many different paradigms come to mind. But that's not how he will start his day. You want to know how he's going to start his day? He will start his day just like every day begins in the temple. Every day ever began in the temple. And according to Jewish tradition, every day ever will begin in the temple. He will start his day, the Kohen Gadol, on Yom Kippur, just like every other day of the Jewish year, by taking out the garbage. Now that's nothing short of incredible. there's a particular ritual that's called Trumat HaDeshen. And we actually have to correct, I think, a misperception about this particular ritual for those who are even aware of it. But first, let me tell you what the ritual is. It's right at the beginning of the portion of Tzav, this week's portion, which, by the way, very often falls round about the time of Purim, just like it does this year, the week leading up to Purim. In fact, this year, Shabbat is actually the essence of Purim because we have what's called Purim Mishulash, which means that Purim itself, out of Jerusalem, falls on Friday. Shushan Purim, sort of remembering the day when the battles in the story of Esther actually stopped inside the walled city of Shushan, falls this year on Shabbat itself, and therefore we don't read the Megillah, we don't celebrate it on Shabbat, but we celebrate it on Sunday. But of course, give the Jews the opportunity for a three-day holiday, and everybody grabs it. So this year is really a three-day Purim holiday. So we read this parsha in the midst of Purim, okay? And right at the beginning of this portion, just after a quick one-verse description of the Olah, the whole burnt offering, the Pasuk tells us, in chapter 6, verse 3, Perek Vav, Pasuk Gimel, V'lavash ha-kohen mido vad u'michnasei vad. The Kohen puts on his regular linen clothing, as opposed to like the special golden clothing for the special services of Yom Kippur. And even though here it's not talking about Yom Kippur, this ritual applies, according to Jewish tradition, to Yom Kippur. In other words, this is not going to be a special moment. This is going to be part of the everyday. Yilbash al basaro, he wears this clothing, this regular bland clothing, nothing else underneath, nothing interfering. Ve'herim et ha-deshen, and he lifts up the ashes, asher tochal ha'esh ha-ta'olah l'mizbeach, that are consumed. In other words, once the sacrifice is consumed on the altar, it leaves behind, obviously, ash. And specifically the olah, the whole burnt offering, since the entire animal, the entire sacrifice is burnt, leaves more ash. And the Kohen in the morning comes up the kevesh, he comes up the ramp, and he offers up the ashes. V'samo etzel mizbeach. And he places the ashes, he takes it off the main sort of part of the altar, and he puts it on the side of the mizbeach of the altar. U'pashat et begadav. And he takes off his clothing. V'lavash begadim acherim. And he wears other clothing. Right? And in other words, well, we'll have to see what that other clothing is. And he takes the ashes, which is essentially the refuse, the garbage, the leftover, the gunk that you clean out after you finish your barbecue, el michutz l'machaneh, outside of the camp, el makom tahor, to a pure, to a clean, to a ritually clean place. That's this ritual. The first thing you do in your day, you take out the garbage. So this begs a lot of questions. First of all, why does a Kohen have to do this? Why can't one of the Levites do this? Why can't you get a garbage crew to come in and do this? Second of all, it's very interesting that even though most people refer to this ritual as Trumat HaDeshen, the taking out of the ashes, it's not exactly true. Rashi here, and this is based on Jewish tradition, on Chazal and the Talmud, Rashi makes the point that this is really two rituals. Okay? Ein zu chova el aderech eretz. First of all, when the Kohen takes off his clothing and puts on other clothing, that's not actually an obligation, but that's just derech eretz. That's just good manners. Why? Shelo yilachlech b'otzat adeshen b'gadim shehu meshamesh b'ayin tamid. That he shouldn't, ashes are dirty. And he's wearing his white linen Kohen clothing. So when he actually takes the ashes outside of the Temple Mount, outside of the camp of the Jews, so he shouldn't get his white linen clothing dirty. It's not nice. So he takes the ashes out in like regular clothing. Now that's an interesting discussion what that is, but one could make a case for saying he basically gets into his jeans and t-shirt, right? He gets into his, I'm taking out the garbage clothing. And Rashi gives an allegory, the clothes that you wear when you're cooking the soup in the kitchen are not the same clothes that you wear when you're serving dinner and pouring the wine, right? So he's basically, you know, cooking up the garbage. So he puts on different clothing. Okay. And then Rashi goes on, V'hotzi et adeshin, when he takes out the ashes, kishehu rabeh, he only has to take out the ashes when the pile grows, right? Ve'in makom lamarecha, and there's no room on the altar for the wooden, sort of the, you know, the setting up of the wood in order to burn the sacrifices, right? Then motzio misham, ve'in zechova b'chol yom. And this is not an obligation every day. In other words, taking the ashes out, you don't have to do every day, right? Aval ha-truma chovah b'chol yom. But offering up the ashes, lifting them, placing them on the side of the temple, which is on the side of the altar, the side of the Mizbeach, which is some sort of an offering, that you have to do every day. So this raises also a bunch of questions. First of all, if you're going to take out the garbage, what is this offering up of the garbage? What does that mean? I can picture this, you know? It's Friday morning. I always tell married couples, prospective couples that are, you know, sort of engaged and getting ready to get married, and if I end up doing the wedding, so I have a very simple rule that if I'm going to do somebody's wedding, I won't do it unless I get to learn with them beforehand. This whole show up to the wedding and just do the ceremony is missing something. And it gives you a chance to sort of talk to the couple, get to know them, you know, pick apart any issues they might have. And one of the pieces of advice that I learned the hard way is that whatever you will do the first Friday, the first Erev Shabbat, the first Eve of Shabbat of your married life, you will end up doing for the rest of your life. I made the mistake of taking out the garbage the first Friday we were married, and I've been doing it ever since. So I've got this, you know, sort of imagination that one Friday, I take the garbage bag out of the garbage, and I look at my wife who's in the kitchen, and I say, honey, this is my garbage offering. She'd look at me like I was whacked. I mean, what is that? And then you actually, if you've already lifted up the ashes, why do you put it on the side of the altar? Take it out already. No. You put it on the side, and you're obligated to do that every day, and no less than a Kohen has to do that, and even the Kohen Gadol himself, the high priest, has to do this as the beginning of the day on Yom Kippur, which, by the way, is not the beginning of Yom Kippur, because, of course, Yom Kippur begins the night before, but it is the beginning of the day in the morning. And then there's a separate part of the service, which you do later on, when the ash grows, and at that point you take it out. So what is that all about? What is this ashes offering? And what does it mean that you take it out, and why is it the Kohen who does it? And why do you have to wear specific clothes? And why, when you actually take it out, you don't have to wear specific clothes? What's the meaning of this ritual? And why does this appear here, right next to the whole burnt offering, and sort of at the beginning of the portions in Vayikra that begin to detail the sacrifices, the korbanot? So I once heard an interesting story, which gave me a lot of pause for thought. Heard this by way of an email about a fellow who is actually pretty well known here in Israel. He was one of the Pilim, one of the active members of the Jewish Agency in the post-Holocaust period, when they were doing everything they could to bring Jewish refugees to Israel. His name was Baruch Duv Devani, and he served as the executive director of the Jewish Agency's Aliyah Department. And he told a story that in the winter of 1956, right after the Sinai campaign, right, which was, you know, sort of here in Israel a war, Poland and the USSR, this was, of course, in the height of the Iron Curtain, had just signed a treaty allowing all Polish citizens who had fled to Russia during World War II to return to Poland. Right? Jewish or not, they had the right to return as long as they were Polish citizens on September 1st, 1939, which was the day the war broke out, right? If you remember, so, you know, Russia and Germany had made a pact, and they split Poland in half. And post-war, Russia sort of had to come good to some degree. So all these refugees were allowed to go back to Poland. There are those that suggest that this was Russia's way of getting rid of literally hundreds of thousands of Jews that were now living in Russia. So as a result of this treaty, thousands of Jews throughout Russia began to return to Poland, and the majority of them subsequently immigrated to Israel. And Baruch Duv Devani spent that year, and actually the next year, in Poland, helping to organize this mass aliyah to Israel, right, which was a very young state of 8 years old. So one December morning, when the temperature in Warsaw had reached 19 degrees below, right, he arrived at the Israeli embassy where they were stationed for, you know, immigration work. And as usual, the courtyard was filled with dozens of people who'd come from Russia to emigrate to Eretz Israel, to Israel. And he stopped and he spoke to different people and they had questions for him, whatever. And he describes this experience as a tremendously joyous experience because he was essentially a vehicle for bringing Jews back home to the land of Israel. He himself was a religious fellow with a kippah on his head. And at one point he noticed an old Jew standing in the corner of the courtyard. He was bone thin. He had barely any flesh on his body. His dim eyes lacked any spark of life. His cheekbones were protruding from his face. His clothes were tattered and torn despite the bitter cold. And after a while, he realized that this old man, this fellow, wanted to speak with him, and that he was simply waiting for him to finish talking to the other refugees. So when he finished, right, he walked over to this gentleman who asked if he was from Jerusalem. So he said, yes, I'm from Yerushalayim. So he asked him if he knew Rav Kook of blessed memory. By this time in the 50s, Rav Kook had passed away. Rav Kook actually died before the State of Israel was born. So he said, yes, he had been privileged actually to benefit from Rav Kook's Torah and from many of his inspiring lectures and discourses. And at that moment, the man burst into tears. And he said, what a shame, what a tragedy that I did not listen to Rav Kook. And he continued to sob for a while. And when he finally calmed down a bit, he told Baruch Devdevani his story. He said his biggest problem in life was his lack of da'at, his lack of wisdom, of knowledge. In the early 1920s, this fellow was a big manufacturer in one of Poland's famous industrial cities. And one day he decided to take a trip to Eretz Israel, to Israel, and to spend Pesach, to spend Passover there. So being a religious Jew, he visited Rav Kook right away upon his arrival. And he wanted to seek advice from him and to talk to him. Of course, this is the 20s when nobody really saw what was coming, late 20s. Rav Kook warmly encouraged him to seek out the good of the land, to consider settling there. And after a few weeks of touring, he returned to Rav Kook and he asked him, among other things, what he should do regarding the second day of Yom Tov, right? There's the festival of Pesach was approaching. And some of you may know that the first day and the last day of the festivals are actually sort of, I guess you could call them, they're called Yom Tov. They're not sort of as similar to a weekday as the middle of the festival, known as Chol HaMoed. And the festival basically is, involves many prohibitions as well as many obligations. You're not allowed to do work. You're not allowed to, get in your car, all sorts of stuff like that. Now, in Israel, we only keep one day. In other words, there's only one day of festival where one doesn't do labor, right? But in America, for various historical reasons that relate to sort of the fact that it took a while for the messengers to let the Jews out of Israel know that they're, sort of which day the festival fell on, the tradition became that those of you outside of Israel would keep 2 days, right? And that's called, that's what it's become known as, 2 days of Yom Tov or one day of Yom Tov, right? And the question becomes, what do you do if you're an Israeli in America, let's say, or if you're an American in Israel? So here was an American, his custom was to keep 2 days, right, of sort of not working. But here he was surrounded by Israelis who were all keeping 1 day. So he wasn't sure what to do, seeing that he was a tourist. So the Rav answered with a smile, Rav Kook. He said to him, very simple, decide right now to bring your family here and to build a factory in the land of Israel. And then you can keep 1 day of Yom Tov already this Pesach, this Passover, like all the inhabitants of Eretz Israel, even if you have to go back afterwards and finish up your affairs. So this tourist, he took his answer sort of with a smile, and the holiday was still a few weeks away. So he figured he would come back at a later date and pose the question again and maybe get a more practical answer. He figured Rav Kook was just being cute, right? So a few days before Pesach, he was back in Jerusalem, and he went to Rav Kook and he asked him the question again. And this time Rav Kook answered him quite sternly. He said, I already told you, you should move here. You should decide now that you're moving here, and then you can keep 1 day of Yom Tov, even if you must return to Poland after Passover, after Pesach, to settle your affairs. So the man tells Baruch Devdevani, I said to Rav Kook, right, he's recounting the story, I said to him, excuse me, Rabbi, I thought about it at great length, but in the end, my intention is to return to the diaspora. My dot, in other words, what I have in mind, is to return to the diaspora, to return to Poland. So how can I celebrate like the residents of Eretz Israel 1 day? So the Rav Kook banged his hand on the table and said with great emotion, "Your dat is to return to Poland? That's nothing but a lack of dat. It's a lack of sense." And with that, he stopped the conversation. And the man continued, now it's 1956. It's almost 30 years later. He continued in a broken voice, and he said to Baruch Devdivani, "I didn't listen to Rav Kook. I returned to the diaspora and remained there. I lost my wife, my children, and my grandchildren in the Holocaust, and here I am today, lonely and desolate. I've come back here with nothing after wandering for years through Russia, and I constantly recall Rav Kook's prophetic words that going back to Poland is nothing but lack of dat, lack of common sense." Now, this story, by the way, is in An Angel Among Men by Rav Simcha Raz, and I got it in an email, and I've been thinking about it. That's a very difficult story. Very difficult story. How many of us walk through life and look back at moments and wish that we could change them? How many of us consider the garbage that we carry with us and wish that there was a way to take it out of the camp? I have a close friend who I think I mentioned to you last week, Moise, and he was in the library, or I should say in the classroom above the library, the night of the terrible terrorist attack in Merkaz Arav, right, the week and a half ago. And they were just finishing Maariv, and there's a whole story that they'd never minyan, and that's why they weren't walking out sort of when the terrorist walked in. And when they heard the shooting and realized it was shooting, they barricaded themselves in, turned off the lights, and lay on the floor. And this Shabbat, he was asked to give the Dvar Torah in our synagogue yesterday. And he spoke. He spoke about Purim. He spoke about Esther. He spoke about hiddenness. He spoke about the question of how we, some of what we talked about last week, how you deal with Adar and with the month of Purim and receiving joy after such a terrible event. And at the end of his speech, his voice broke, and he was holding back the tears. And I remember thinking to myself, sort of yesterday, you know, I mean, I have to go talk to him. He is clearly struggling, and I understand that. That's a very difficult event, because at the end of the day, you're in a room with a group of adults, and a terrorist walks in, and for 10 minutes, he's killing children. And you barricaded yourself inside a room. Now, it matters little that that's an absurd sort of guilt to carry. First of all, when you hear the sound of 600 bullets nonstop for 10 minutes, you have no way of knowing that that's one terrorist. There could be five of them. You have, in his case, no army experience, right? And in fact, one of the things they tell you is that if you're in a civilian in an event like that, the smartest thing to do is to close off the area that you're in to prevent further victims, to make it more difficult for the terrorist. But that's irrelevant, because the question is not what reality is, the question is what he's carrying with him, right? I wonder if hidden inside the ritual of the Trumat HaDeshen is this exact issue. You know, one of the challenges you have in life, everybody has a routine, right? And the more you can create a routine for yourself, the more you can get done. You know, everybody has a routine. I actually, you know, every time I start my day, I have an order. I go through email, and then I go through my phone messages. I have a cell phone. I have a regular phone. I go to my whiteboard where the important to-dos are. I go through any receipts I have left over. I go through my paper pile. I go to the calendar. This is an order of what you do, right? And that order allows you to get things done. And one of the most important things that a person has to do in creating order in his life is he has to be able to define things. You know, we receive an enormous amount of, for lack of a better term, stuff. Right? Stuff comes into our life. And one of the first questions you have to ask yourself when stuff comes into your life is, what exactly is that stuff? Is that stuff valuable or is it garbage? If it's garbage, get rid of it. If it's valuable, then you have to ask yourself, well, what do you do with that? Is it actionable? Is it something you can do? Or is it something that you just want to keep for reference or whatever? If it's for reference, you have to have a place for it to reference it. If it's something that's actionable, is it something you can do in under 2 or 3 minutes? If it's something you can do in under 2 or 3 minutes, just do it. Don't let it pile up. And if it's something that's more of a project, create a project file. And in, by the way, this 60-second sort of diatribe is a world of organizational thought. But right at the beginning of that process is the ability to recognize what your garbage is, to recognize what you have to get rid of. But what's interesting is that we think that those things that we have to get rid of, right, the fact that we have to get rid of them means that they have no value for us. That's not true. Because the garbage that comes into your life for a reason, just like the things that are valuable. You learn from what you want to get rid of as much about yourself as you do from what you don't want to get rid of. You know? You sit at your email, right? And I don't know, I have tried, I can't even tell you how many different ways to prevent spam from coming into my computer. And, you know, you have some success, you don't have all success. I don't really believe that there's a foolproof way from preventing certain types of spam, pornography, or whatever it might be, from coming into your computer, right? So this stuff comes in. So I learned already, you know, at certain points, you know, you create a junk mail folder, but you have to go into the junk mail folder and you have to delete it all. So basically you're going in and you're deleting, you know, garbage, pornography, schmutz. But that's a blessing. The fact that you realize that that's schmutz, that's a blessing. The fact that you don't want that in your life, that's a blessing, right? Somebody sits down at your table and he starts telling you a story. And you realize, I don't know, it's a dirty joke. Or you realize it's worse than that. It's gossip, it's slander about another human being. And you make a mental decision that that's garbage. Now you have to decide how to get rid of it, right? But before you get rid of it, you actually offer it up. You put it on the side as if to say, there's value to recognizing that this is deshen, that this is ash, that this is destroyed. There's value to making the conscious decision that I'm going to make this destroyed in my life. And I wonder if that isn't at the root of this ritual. And by the way, go a stage further. Rav Shimshon Farel Hirsch says an amazing thing. He says when you start your day, before you begin your day anew, you have to get rid of the garbage that brought you down yesterday. And if you can do that, if you can let go of the stuff that's bringing you down, then you can start your new day all over again. You're a totally new person today. Because the stuff that brought you down yesterday, that's deshen, that's burnt, that's consumed. You might not have to get rid of it right now. You might not be able to get rid of it right now. But the first stage of getting rid of it is recognizing that it's garbage. And that is the yesod, that is the essence of the Trumas HaDeshen. And that's why the Kohen, maybe, wears his regular clothes. He doesn't wear the special golden clothes, because the whole point is that this ritual, that even Yom Kippur, the beginning of the day of Yom Kippur, begins with letting go of the ordinary stuff. The stuff that's the garbage in your life. You know, this fellow, and look, you know, we can only begin, we can't even imagine what it must be like to lose on such a monumental level. And never mind to wander through communist Russia post-Holocaust for so many years, and the suffering this individual might have gone through. But everything that they did to him, and everything he lost, notwithstanding, he still has the ability to make a decision as to whether he continues to lose. Hanging on to that moment, and viewing that moment, that piece of advice of Rav Kook, as a mistake, viewing that as something that came into his life that he missed, means that he's not living in the moment now, he's still back in 1927. And every moment that he goes back to 1927 and doesn't let go, that deshen, that ash, is still sitting on his altar. He's not ready to offer up into the world who he can be and what he can accomplish. So please don't misunderstand this. God forbid that anybody should think that I'm offering a judgment call on something we can't understand. But we can choose to struggle with such a story and to learn from it. And I think that's true, you know, these are obviously much more monumental issues, but it's true in the everyday. You know, you're sitting in your kitchen, and you spent all morning cooking breakfast, because it's your husband's birthday, and then one of the kids comes in and knocks the bowl over, and the whole thing goes flying on the floor. So the breakfast is gone. You're not going to be able to pick it up off the floor. Now you decide what else you're going to lose. Do you suddenly decide that that breakfast has become deshen? Right? I can't eat it anymore. Do you put it on its side and recognize for whatever the reason he's obviously not meant to have this breakfast? Or do you decide to throw your child's feelings and self-worth down onto the floor with the breakfast? That is a moment of decision. And you can't just right away throw it out. You have to take a moment to appreciate that process. And that's why the obligation that is daily is not to take the garbage out. It's just to be able to put it aside, to recognize that it's garbage. What you do with it, how do you get rid of it? That's the next stage. And that's all a part of the ritual of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple and the sacrifices that we struggle with every day. So that's a little bit of food for thought. It goes without saying that many people think that the sacrifices and the rituals are a thing of the past. There's some ancient ritual. But as you start to study every detail of every moment of what went on in the temple, you realize that these rituals, these traditions, have enormous messages for us every day. So that's a little food for thought.
Benny, you told last week that you would talk about Purim, right?
Ah, you were right. We did say we would speak about Purim. Well, you know what? I'll tell you a quick idea. I'll give you a quick idea on Purim. Okay, that's fair. We forgot about that, okay? I got so into this idea, I forgot about that's true. You know, there's a tradition that says that that the word, you know, in the story of Esther, in the Megillah, the scroll of Esther, right? So there's no mention of God's name. In fact, the name Esther also means lahastir, hidden. The story of Esther is the story of hiddenness because even the miracle that occurred was a hidden miracle. I'm sure there were many skeptics in the days of Esther that didn't look at it as a miracle, right? One person's miracle is another person's natural. To me, the Six-Day War is miraculous. To another person, it's just a military victory. So the Talmud tells us, Jewish tradition teaches, that the word king, the word melech in the Megillah, refers not only to the king Ahasuerus, who was the Persian king, but also to the ultimate king of kings, to Hashem. Now, it's interesting to note that that's only true when the word melech is mentioned alone. If it says HaMelech Ahasuerus, then it refers specifically to Ahasuerus. But if it just says HaMelech, so when you start to read the Megillah, and you realize where the word melech appears, for example, Esther says to King Ahasuerus, Im al ha-melech tov, if it will be good in the eyes of the king, right, to annul the decree. And one way of understanding that Esther understands is that ultimately she has to do her bit. She has to try to affect the outcome of the story of Purim, but ultimately it's God who decides. When King Ahasuerus tells Esther that the decree that the nations of the world will try to destroy the Jewish people on a particular day, that decree cannot be annulled, right? Because it has already gone out with the signet ring of the king, there too it only says a melech. Now that's a very difficult line to understand. How could it be that Hashem cannot annul his decree? One way of understanding that is we view the world as divided up into good and evil. Right, we see, you know, righteous people benefiting. We see boys sitting and learning Torah, and we see that as good. We see terrorism and evil and even illnesses as bad. But the truth is, if you take a step back, you start to realize we don't really know what we're looking at. We started talking about this last week, right? All of this is part of life. And the recipe is given to us in totality precisely because there is so much to learn and so much to struggle with. If there was only good in the world would really have no meaning. And we would have no free choice. And the challenge of Purim, more than on any other festival, is the struggle that we have to find the wisdom to know the difference. To be able to recognize that which we have to fight against and that which we have to accept. Right? And sometimes in the most confusing fashion, you know, I'll give you an extreme example that I actually am still struggling with some 3 years later, right? For whatever the reason, Hashem decreed that 8,000 Jews living in Gush Katif, in some of the most beautiful communities in the world, holy places, that they should be forced to leave their homes and expelled by no less than Israeli soldiers. That's just a paradigm that still I struggle to deal with. And there were so many people who railed against that decision. And maybe it was good. We had to struggle with it. We had to fight it. It shouldn't be just a given. But once it occurred, it occurred. Now we have to struggle with what we're supposed to learn from it and what to do with it. And you see that there are those people who are able to accept it. Not that they agree with it. They don't agree with it. the ability to accept it and to try to struggle with where to go from here is very different from allowing yourself to be filled with anger at what should have been, right? And that's a very big challenge. And I wonder if that's not hidden in the story of Esther. But again, that's a longer discussion. I want to wish everybody really a Freilich and Purim, a wonderful Purim, a meaningful Purim, a powerful Purim. Hashem should bless us. You know, Purim is always a time of redemption for the Jewish people. Many great miracles occur to the Jewish people on Purim. It's not accidental that the Gulf War ended on Purim, and many other instances.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.